I'm author and athlete Brad Kearns. Welcome to the Be Rad Podcast, where we explore ways to pursue peak performance with passion throughout life. Visit bradkearns.com for great resources on healthy eating, exercise, and lifestyle. And here we go with the show.
Being able to get on the field or on the court for every game, and because it's, you know, the pro sport season, no matter what the sport, is relentless. But it gives you a pass-fail and all of those variables, and then gives you a report with drills and how you can personally improve. I would be curious to see what they're doing on the flip side too, because as you know, as a triathlete, what you take out, you have to put back in somehow.
Hey listeners, get ready for a lively podcast on all aspects of sports with the one and only Lindsay Barra, host of the Food of the Gods podcast and longtime sports journalist across a variety, incredible variety of sports, and a longtime athlete in an amazing variety of sports as well. She worked at MajorLeagueBaseball.com for 5 years, established herself as an authority on baseball fitness and injuries, and was on TV talking about her stories frequently. Then she transitioned to a long career, 13 years as a senior writer for ESPN magazine. So really the highest level of sports journalism. And she covered ice hockey, tennis, baseball, and 3 Olympic games. She's a longtime athlete, played varsity softball at University of North Carolina, played on the men's ice hockey team, club team at North Carolina, was the captain of her high school boys hockey team. She's into golf. She's into tennis these days. And she has an amazing assortment of insights on training technology, the progression of training methods in sports. We have some opinions and some reflections, like a proper sports talk show about who's the fittest athlete. And are these athletes eating appropriately? Do we have where do we see in the future of nutrition for elite athletes? She's interviewed a ton of people, auto racers, PGA Tour golfers, Olympic athletes in a variety of sports, heptathlon, long distance running, a lot of baseball players, of course, as her original niche. And yes, she's the granddaughter of the legendary Yogi Berra, who was a great athlete and manager for so long in baseball, a true baseball legend. And she's on the board of directors of the Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center in Little Falls, New Jersey. My favorite aspect about Yogi Berra is he's possibly the most quotable athlete of all times. Amusing, hilarious, and also really insightful. And Lindsay's going to give you some of her favorite quotes from grandfather. So enjoy that toward the end of the show. And check out the Food of the Gods podcast. Particularly interesting to me is interviewing these athletes at the top of their game in a variety of sports and finding out how they eat. I think that has tremendous weight and relevance, especially compare and contrast to the research and the science and how we obsess on if something is validated by a scientific study, then it must be good for us. But I also like to put in a huge plug for what real athletes are doing every day when they're suiting up in the National Hockey League, NFL, Major League Baseball, and the Olympics, and weigh that carefully. And the reason I say that is because she reports back a surprising lack of extreme eating strategies by the elite athletes. So there's not to be found much of keto, primal, paleo, intermittent fasting, time-restricted feeding. And generally, the common thread that you're going to find with the elite athletes is eating wholesome natural foods and avoiding junk foods. And we talk about that too. Is that really true? Are these athletes still stuffing their face, like we learned from Usain Bolt at the 2000 Olympics, joking about how many chicken McNuggets he ate in the Olympic Village because they were free? I think you're going to love the show. If you're interested in sports, Lindsay is lively, fun. She's got some tremendous insights. And here we go with Lindsay Barra, host of the Food of the Gods podcast. Lindsay Barra, how are you?
I am just peachy, Brad. How are you?
I'm so glad to connect through our association with the wonderful Digitent Podcast Network. And boy, they said you got to check out this lady's show. It's pretty interesting. You might like it. And I'm super excited to to have you on and discuss what you're doing with Food of the Gods and what you've learned from this amazing smattering of athletes that you've interviewed in so many different sports. So first, I'd love to know your background with all that journalism and covering a variety of sports and also your own athletic background. So let's tee it up for Lindsay Barra here.
This might take me a second. So I grew up playing all sports, like all of them, with the exception of really golf and tennis. I play golf now, but I did not play golf as a kid. But I played everything other than that growing up. I played soccer, ice hockey, and softball in high school. I was the captain of the boys' varsity hockey team at my high school in Jersey. And then I went on to play varsity softball and men's club hockey at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, go Tar Heels. And then I went to journalism school at UNC. And after college, more athletic background. During that, I was an ocean lifeguard for 8 years. So swimming, running, paddling, rowing, you know, all that beach stuff was like on the docket all summer for me all the time. Then after college, I started working at ESPN Magazine, where I covered mostly hockey, tennis, baseball, did a little boxing. I covered 3 Olympic Games, Torino, Beijing, and Vancouver. I was at ESPN Magazine for 13 years. Then I was at MLB.com and MLB Network, covering Major League Baseball on TV and for the interwebs for 5 years. Then I was freelance for 4 years, writing a lot for like Men's Health and Sports Business Journal, started to get a little bit more into the fitness side of things at that point. And then most recently, 2 months ago, I started a job doing content for Tonal, the fitness company that you see LeBron James and Serena Williams doing ads for. But I'm also hosting Food of the Gods, as you mentioned. I'm a board member at my grandpa Yogi Berra's museum, the Yogi Berra Museum and Learning Center in Little Falls, New Jersey. We've got a really fun documentary coming out on him called It Ain't Over that's premiering at the Tribeca Film Festival. And I also work with Tom House, the legendary pitching coach Tom House, on his biomechanics pitching app, which is called Mustard, where you can get biomechanical analysis and free coaching for your youth pitchers. So I do a lot of stuff.
Oh my gosh. I want to pick up with the last thing you said. So what are you doing for this app and how does that app work? That seems like a fascinating technology.
So I met Tom years ago when I was working at ESPN Magazine. Tom is kind of universally known as the father of modern pitching mechanics. He was a big league pitcher, but then became a coach. He was Nolan Ryan's pitching coach, Randy Johnson, Greg Maddux, all the famous quarterbacks over the
104 last people. Year. That's a good coach right there. Nolan Ryan. Does Nolan Ryan still have the speed record for the fastest pitch?
Aroldis Chapman may have beat him with a 105, I think. Oof. However, if you watch the documentary Fastball, it proves that Nolan's was actually faster because of the way they measure now. Nowadays, they measure about 10 feet in front of the mound. And when Nolan was pitching, the gun caught it a lot closer to home plate, which caused the ball to be measured at a point at which it had lost miles per hour. So even though the new gun reading for Chapman is higher, Ryan's pitch was actually faster.
Just in case you're wondering if this lady's legit or not, now she's on a roll. Okay, how can you dispute that?
That documentary, though, is called Fastball. It's by Jonathan Hawke, and it's pretty fantastic. I think it's available on Netflix, or it's on the interwebs somewhere. You can find it. But anyway, so I met Tom House years ago, and Tom has been working with all those famous pitchers. He was also Tom Brady and Drew Brees' throwing coach, like all the big quarterbacks. And he has been doing biomechanical analyses of pitchers since the late 70s, which is way before biomechanical analyses were cool. And he has 40 years of data on elite level pitchers. He's 75, just turned 75, but he has Parkinson's disease. And he was afraid that if he didn't do something with all of his data, it would be lost to history. So he teamed up with some engineers from MLBAM and some entrepreneurs and developed this pitching app called Mustard that digitized all of his data, and using an AI engine overlays Tom's data over a video of your kid pitching, and it gives you a report with the 11 most important mechanical variables in the pitching delivery: timing, stride length, balance, posture, lift and thrust, stack and track. I'm missing a bunch, but anyway, hip and shoulder separation, the ability to generate torque is a big one, but it gives you a pass fail and all of those variables, and then gives you a report with drills and how you can personally improve. So it's a pretty cool thing.
Unbelievable. It sounds like there's some carryover to the football quarterback throwing the ball, and perhaps even into other sports.
Yeah, rotation is rotation. So eventually they're going to move the app into football, lacrosse, well, first of all, hitting for baseball, golf, you know, and any time you're generating rotational power from the ground up, that force has to move properly through the kinetic sequence for you to get the most power out of your body and into whatever implement you're using. So it's really applicable to everything.
I'm just coming up with a weird question insight here about the amazing progress of technology in sports. And so now these little pitchers all over the place can learn how to throw like a big leaguer. You've seen this so prominently in the golf scene, you know, starting with Tiger Woods coming in and destroying all these soft, wealthy, lazy players that didn't have the competitive edge honed as much as him, and then the fitness and all these things, and now everybody can swing like a robot, as you see on the range. And so we're all nodding our heads, talking about how technology is so prevalent and sports have progressed so much. But also, if we can reflect and sit back and think that, okay, Nolan Ryan was throwing the ball faster than anyone. And that was, almost 50 years ago. And same with some of the old-time golfers. You had Gary Player on the show. So I am making a segue here, people. I'm not just ranting, but like, they shot some pretty low scores with some quote-unquote, inefficient, crappy, old technology clubs, balls, and so forth. So I'm wondering,
Their technology was crappier back then, but they all had that sequencing down pat. Their swing, Gary Player's swing is beautiful. And I think getting kids to learn how to properly throw a baseball at a young age saves their arms from wear and tear. Mm. You have a lot more fun playing if you're not hurt. More kids will stay in baseball if they're having fun because they're not hurt. And, a pitching coach is $200 an hour. So giving kids access to that kind of coaching that can really change their lives in sport for free is pretty amazing. I mean, I grew up in a baseball family, and Tom House obviously loves baseball and wants to share that love of the game with kids all over the place. But again, you're not having fun if you're hurt all the time.
Good point. I think also with just becoming more resilient and adaptable with modern fitness techniques, where you're not getting injured and you're having more fun at all ages. Because I think back in the day, some poor kid tore his knee up in a football practice sophomore year, and his athletic career was doomed forever because they went in there with a knife. And now we're in there doing mini bands and cords and balance drills and all the things that we see the professional athletes lasting for 18-year careers as a norm, rather than, just the freaks of the old times.
Yeah, functional strength is obviously such an important component, no matter what sport you're playing. It's important for normal life too. So, yeah.
So that journey, you've been so deeply immersed into sports since you were a kid as a participant and as a journalist. And I wonder if that helped you, with your opportunities. Did it matter? Did they weigh that fact appropriately that you were an actual player rather than just someone who could, cover the sport?
I think at ESPN Magazine, they did for sure. And once they realized that I was good at explaining like the nuance of athletic movement to normal people, which was one of the reasons Tom House and I hit it off really quickly, because I was able to sort of understand the sciencey stuff that he was saying and then explain it in writing to someone with no science background. And that has been super helpful throughout my entire career. I mean, even right now, I'm doing a bunch of golf content for Tonal because they have a partnership with Michelle Wee West, and there's a whole bunch of golf workouts on Tonal now. And I'm talking about like why your glutes are important in your golf swing and why hip mobility is important and how to generate torque in your swing. But you can't explain that like you're writing some kind of scientific paper. You have to write it in words that the average Joe on the driving range can understand. And I think my background playing sports, and really a lot of it came from doing yoga for many years and being able to kind of mentally articulate the different parts of your body. It helped me a lot to be able to talk about it in terms that normal folks can digest.
So in your case, you're using these disparate skills. I assume you're someone who's digging into the research, pulling out these scientific insights about torque, and then reflecting on your yoga experience or whatever, and then trying to find the words to convey it. It sounds like an awesome challenge.
Yeah, and it's not just necessarily me going through the science. I do get the chance to talk to the experts, the people who are actually doing the research, and they can kind of tell me what their theories are and explain what the research shows. But those people use a lot of sciencey words. So that's where I have to like, you know, break out the thesaurus and distill it so it's a little bit more digestible.
So how about this Gary Player guy? He's fascinated me for so long because he seems like the original fitness freak in elite major professional sports. And he, listeners, Lindsay will give you sufficient background, but he's an old-time golfer from South Africa.
Yeah. So we had Gary on Food of the Gods last fall, I think it was. Anyway, but
did he challenge you to a push-up contest or anything?
Yeah, I mean, no.
This guy's a piece of work.
He's a hoot. He's a total hoot, right? Yeah. And he's very outspoken in how he thinks that people don't move enough and Americans are lazy. And, you know, he's not wrong. A lot of us don't move enough and a lot of us are lazy. So he's not wrong. But he is 86 years old and he's still in the gym 5 days a week. He plays golf 5 days a week. He still shoots his point of pride is that he still shoots his age. And really at 86 years old, like two over par, he considers a bad day, but he was also a competitive diver growing up, and he can still at 86 do back and front flips off the springboard on his pool or off like the, there's a video on his Instagram of him doing a backflip off the side of a boat at 86 years old. And he'll tell you that he you know, eats raw garlic and raw red onion every day because he thinks it's, you know, good for your gut and all this kind of stuff. He's very particular about what he eats, and he's still doing push-ups and leg presses and in the gym all the time. And he really is just in incredible shape for someone of his age. And he's still an incredible golfer.
I think he also stakes claim to having flown the most miles in an airplane of any human alive, which is pretty validated, I think.
I think, and it doesn't sound out of the realm of possibility to me too, because he's from South Africa and he goes home fairly frequently. So just those trips back and forth to South Africa would give him more miles than most folks.
Yeah, he was playing on the PGA Tour for years, and you know, he won several major titles. He's one of the greatest golfers of all time. And oh man, the commitment to fitness was something so new to golf, and I think he did a great job awakening people to the importance of what you're eating besides what club you're hitting.
Absolutely. In the 60s, there's all, like, if you Google Gary Player, there's all these great old black and white pictures of him like lifting with, you know, steel plates and whatnot. It's good.
So you decided to start this podcast, Food of the Gods, and focus on, in particular, focus on the dietary habits of elite athletes. Or tell me about it, that brainstorm and how it's gone.
It's about the, how elite athletes eat and train to fuel performance is my tagline. So what kind of workouts they do in season and in the off season, and then how their nutrition is on a day-to-day basis and how that varies through the off season. You know, I love asking people what their cheat meals are because everybody's got them, but for the most part, you know, they're all eating pretty well and taking care of their bodies. And, you know, they've all got the recovery methods that work for them. There's so many recovery options out there and not everything works for everybody. So I like to ask them, you know, which ones are they, you know, they use on a regular basis. A lot of them are, things folks can do at home, like, the portable massage gun or a foam roller or an Epsom salt bath or just stretching, getting a lot of sleep. That's important to everybody. But it has been interesting, listening to them talk about their different kinds of diets and what they eat before they work out, what they eat after they work out. I've taken a couple of different tips from a bunch of them. Danielle Collins, who is one of our top ranked American tennis players. She told me about these Noca superfood smoothies. It looks like a baby food pouch, but they've got 5 grams of plant protein in them. And they're like in the little door pocket in my car and in my golf bag. I love them. I carry them pretty much everywhere now because it's such a good snack and it doesn't need to be refrigerated and there's no chocolate on it that melts like most protein bars. So I've even taken a lot of tips from them and kind of incorporated them into my everyday life.
So do you see some common popular techniques, strategies, foods through the guest list? And then also, what are some of the most freaky or unusual things that you've heard?
The freakiest was definitely Bradley Bozeman, NFL offensive lineman's pregame meal, which includes like 2 steaks, a baked potato with sour cream, a bagel with cream cheese, like all this stuff that I could not function with if I had it in my stomach, so that was like, he was the most extreme, but most we've had, one ice hockey player who is a pretty strict intermittent faster. But with the exception of those two, everybody just is a pretty balanced eater, like lean meats, vegetables, fruit, whole grains, like complex carbohydrate, they don't shy away from carbohydrate. A lot of the athletes, I think what people will find most interesting, like for example, we had Emma Coburn on the other day, and she's a very fit, very thin American steeplechase runner, which is a pretty gnarly race. And she eats a ton of carbs. She eats like pancakes after her training, obviously not like, ice cream sundaes, but she's eating stuff that are going to fuel her. She's obviously burning a lot of carbohydrate, but I think that the biggest common denominator is that these guys are not afraid of carbs in the way a lot of normal people are.
Progressive health enthusiasts, which is a lot of the work that I've been in this ancestral health space, primal paleo, keto, yeah, carnivore, all these great things that people are reporting, life-changing benefits, especially getting away from things that have been irritating to their digestive health. Okay. And then also reducing excess body fat with any strategy that takes you away from the disastrous consumption of processed foods that represents the standard modern diet.
Well, and I will say that all of these athletes who are consuming carbohydrate are not consuming processed foods. They're eating sweet potatoes and, brown rice, things like that. Like the processed food is not on the list.
Wow. I mean, I think that's insight number one, is that the elite functioning human is staying away from garbage. I'm not sure. Maybe you've had, a cultivated guest list where you're talking to people who do care about their diet, because I suspect there's still some optimization to be had, especially in these high performing athletes. I mean, Usain Bolt was laughing and joking about his consumption of chicken McNuggets in the Olympic training center. And I think, the major professional sports teams, some of them, like Dr. Kate Shanahan, had a program going with the Lakers. And I was familiar with that. And the guy who ran it for her, Tim DeFrancesco, their former strength and conditioning coach, where he'd place a to-go order from Whole Foods for a buffet meal for 20 people. And he'd have it ready after the games. And it was, highly structured of the very best foods. But in general, it's possible that, I don't know if you have any insights of what level of junk food is still found in the pantries, lockers, automobiles of the elite athletes.
So we've had a few different nutritionists for pro sports team on the podcast. We had Lerone Sarig from the San Francisco Giants and Anthony Zamora from the Utah Jazz. And they definitely have the highest quality stuff available for these athletes. And now it's literally 3 meals a day. You can come in there for breakfast and have them make you an omelet with fresh veggies or oatmeal or whatever you want. And then there's, you know, all different options for lunch and dinner. I think they do have a little bit junkier foods like chips and cookies stuff available. And everybody says that the younger players will still eat some of the crappy foods, but the older you get in the league and the more you learn and realize that what you eat matters. You know, when you're 20 years old, you might be able to get away with eating a Big Mac every day for lunch. But when you're 35 and trying to stay in the league, every little thing gives you an edge and you're going to give up those Big Macs and go more towards, you know, the protein shake with your beet powder for nitric oxide and your, you know, collagen protein to help your joints and all those things instead of the Big Mac that you got away with when you were a teenager. So I think, like everything, people live and learn, and pro athletes are no different.
Oh my gosh. And the stakes are so high these days, and the incentives and the microscope as well. And I would assume that mentality possibly carries over into off-season behavior patterns, how frequently they're in the gym or doing their rehabilitative mini band stretches or Theragun treatment sessions and so forth.
I think the recovery stuff becomes really important in the season because of the travel. I think that physical activity is one thing, but recovering from so many flights and so many hours in a plane is really difficult during the regular season. In the off season, they just have a little bit more time, you know, like their workout is the priority of the day and whatever training they're doing, but they're not having to go get on a plane and fly to the next place or play the actual game. So there's a little bit more downtime in the off season for them to work on things that they kind of got stuck with during the season. But during the season, then that's when you have like the pitchers doing the shoulder maintenance program between starts and really paying attention to being able to get on the field or on the court for every game. And because it's, you know, the pro sport season, no matter what the sport, is relentless.
Yeah, for sure. It's, you know, maybe even an equivalent stressor to the actual physical contest is that travel schedule that they have. When Tim was with the Lakers, he was telling me about how the jet would take off after an Eastern time zone game and fly them back to Los Angeles, where they arrive at 2 a.m. or some ridiculous time. And I said, why don't they just stay in a hotel in the city and get a good night's sleep and then fly home? And he said, because they'd go out that night. And so they might as well just get him on the plane and fly him home. I'm like, both of those are pretty terrible sounding for the highest performing athlete. But it sounds like there's been some progression from the sense that these athletes are out there partying and going to the clubs and then throwing in 30 points the next night.
Yeah, I think some of the teams have started to modify that super late night flight thing, but there are guys who just make the decision that they'd rather wake up at home with their kids if they don't get a lot of days off. So it just kind of depends on what the team's like personal priorities are, or, you know, sometimes the schedule is ridiculous and you play on one coast and you actually have a game the next day. So you have to fly home. That's, you know, it can be nutty like that too.
Yeah, and the NFL playing once a week, but those Thursday night games or those Saturday night games. And then I wonder what it's like to recover from the physical pounding of just an ordinary NFL game for the player. I mean, how are they coming on day one, day two, day three?
Yeah, I think that Monday is usually like a full day off, or some guys like to do active recovery workouts, but like that seems like it's like a hot and cold tub and get my massage and go in the infrared sauna kind of day for everybody. Yeah. I mean, I can't even imagine getting hit repeatedly by a 330-pound lineman. So I can't.
Yeah. I'm actually wondering, like, if Brad Kearns came in for one play and went across the middle and took a shot, it's possible I could get killed in one tackle. It, you know, if my neck snaps because I don't have the ability to handle one hit on one play in the NFL. Seriously.
Yeah, I'm not sure we should try that.
Yeah.
Although if you survive, it might make you like a YouTube star.
George Plimpton. I use that term sometimes, like he's the George Plimpton of the biohacking, or he's the George Plimpton of blank. And I get a blank look from anyone that's under 40 years old. I'm like, you never heard of George Plimpton? It's like, oh my gosh, come on.
Oh, God.
Maybe you should explain who he is for the young listener that's never heard that word.
Who did he fight?
he fought some elite boxer. Was it a heavyweight?
I can't remember which boxer he actually fought. George Plimpton was a writer who decided to get in the ring with a real boxer. And I don't remember what year, and I don't remember who it was, but he's pretty famous for doing it.
Yeah, he was like the ultimate participatory journalist. And
didn't
so he also
do a bull fight too?
Oh my gosh. I mean, we're gonna have to have some links in the show notes.
I think he did a bullfight.
Yeah, he did training camp for the Detroit Lions and wrote a book called Paper Lion, a fragile Detroit Lion. And he actually got in one play on a preseason game, I think at quarterback or something. But, you know, he went through the whole ordeal as just this ordinary writer guy. And he threw himself into numerous other sports like you're mentioning.
He did do a bullfight. I'm just not wrong about that.
That's one step beyond running with the bulls. Jeez. Yeah. Speaking of the off season and coming down from that incredible travel and competitive schedule, I read this excerpt several years ago and it really stuck with me. It was an interview with Julio Jones, the great wide receiver. Mm-hmm. Is he with Atlanta?
He's got my favorite name in pro sports. I love his name, Julio Jones.
Yeah, it's Bill Simmons' book about basketball had a list of his favorite names for different reasons, a humorous little account in there. The reader can go look that up themselves. But they asked him, tell me about your off-season training strategy. And he says, I don't do anything. I just let my body rest. And I was like, you know what? This could be a glimpse of the athlete of the future at the highest level of sophistication of performing, where really all he needs during the off season is, you know, to walk around the park with his kids, go get a massage.
You might want to take a break from the punishment, but I do believe that what separates elite athletes from the rest of us hacks is their proficiency and skill in their sport. And I think to maintain that, you have to, like, you know, pitchers need to throw most of the year. They might want to take a couple weeks off at the end, but you got to throw, you got to practice your craft and your skill if you want to stay at that elite level now, because at this, in this day and age, what you just said about Julio Jones is very much not the norm. Almost everybody else is working out all year long. And if you want to compete with the top 1% of 1%, you're going to have to do that as well.
Yeah. Isaac Rochelle of the Chargers. He's a former Notre Dame defensive end. He's had a nice career, even though he wasn't expected to be, he wasn't a high draft pick, but he made his way through the NFL for many years now. And he talks about his offseason is more emphasizing yoga, you know, beach sprinting, things that are making him a better athlete. Definitely. And then not necessarily hitting the blocking sleds or doing, extreme football drills, but balancing it.
No, the guys do like more full body things, but like everybody's training is somewhat sport specific. Like there's going to be little elements of skill. Like he might, if you're a football player, like you might do those like hand-eye coordination drills, but you know, like where you're talking about defense and shifting, like it's applicable to sport for sure.
I think the triathletes are in that same camp. Simon Whitfield, Olympic gold medalist and Olympic silver medal triathlete, he talked about his breaks would be 3 weeks and he would sprinkle those in over the course of the year instead of having this big, huge off season. Oh, great. There's no races for 3 months. You're going to sit around and add some body fat and get out of shape. You know, he emphasized the importance of always being in pretty good shape. And of course, 3 weeks is a wonderful break. You're not going to lose much. You're not just sitting on the couch, but you're taking these chunks of time where you give your body a break from the traveling and the extreme training.
I think you see that a lot with fighters too. Like, you know, triathletes don't race all the time. Boxers don't fight every weekend. You fight like every couple of months and you will give yourself a little bit of a break, but you keep yourself, you might like decrease your fitness, like, you know, 3 to 5%. And then in your camp, you ramp it back up, but you keep yourself at a place where it's easy to recover your top level of fitness. You can't fall too far off the wagon or you're going to have a hard time returning to that level.
Speaking of pitching, I was just alarmed to learn that the great Dodgers pitcher, Clayton Kershaw, was pulled out en route to a perfect game after 7 innings. And I want to get your opinion on that because I was just exasperated. Like, are you freaking kidding me?
We're very, we we've had this conversation a lot at Mustard. So Clayton Kershaw is a, he's got, as great as he is, he has a bit of a fragile arm. He was on the injured reserve list a bunch of times last year. He's dealt with injuries in spring training this year. He hadn't pitched more than four innings. And I'm not sure what his pitch count was. I think it was not, he hadn't pitched more than 70 pitches. And he was through seven innings in that perfect game already at 80 pitches. So more innings and more pitches than he was prepared to throw. And I think when Dave Roberts looked at that, he thought, do I want it? We're going to win this game. Is Clayton Kershaw's perfect game more or less important than having him healthy and on my roster for the duration of the season? And Dodgers fans don't want to see him out. So as angry as they were with him getting pulled with the perfect game, you can see Dave Roberts' rationale, and Clayton himself was not upset about it. So that says a lot too, because he knew what Dave was doing for him. And Tom will tell you, it's the greatest thing, regardless of what you think about Clayton getting pulled. It sets a really great example for youth sports to see the Dodgers prioritizing the pitcher's health at that level, you know, where you have a 13-year-old who shouldn't be throwing more than, you know, 85 pitches total, and he's at 120 just because he's the best kid on the team. And that's where kids get hurt. So for coaches at the youth level and parents at the youth level to see health of a pitcher being prioritized like that by the Dodgers is a great example for youth sports and bodes well for the idea of good arms staying good long enough to make it to the big leagues.
You know, I'm sorry, I never thought of that perspective. That's really great. And it also sets a great example for professional sports, because the athletes have been chewed up and spit out as commodities from the dawn of professional sports. So now I'm looking at it from a different perspective than the selfish fan perspective. But I still, I'm going to try to in grade a little bit here. You know, it is entertainment. I'm wondering of the extreme damage of his arm falling off if he were to pitch another inning or another and become one of the there's only 23 perfect games in the history of baseball in 130 years or something. And then as I finish my question to Lindsay here, compare and contrast to Japanese baseball, which my understanding is they have a different philosophy about pitchers and how to strengthen the arm and become a resilient pitcher.
I'm not well versed in what they're doing in Japan, so I can't really answer that side of it. But Clayton, I would just say that, you know, a perfect game is super rare, right? But dancing with flirting with fatigue is very dangerous, right? So once you're tired, when you're throwing with the intent required to throw 100-mile-an-hour fastball, and you need all of your muscles and things to be firing in the right sequence and you know, on full cylinder, once you start to tire, that stuff, the injury risk just goes up, right? And when you get tired, if you listen to Tom House, he'll tell you that like the first thing that you lose is command. If you stop being able to throw strikes, it's probably because you're getting tired. And if Clayton had thrown a few more balls in the previous 10 pitches before he got pulled than in the 10 pitches before that, it would have been a pretty good indication to Dave Roberts that he was really walking that fatigue line. And I mean, look, I don't know. I think that most pro athletes will tell you, whether they are really believe it or not, that they're putting the team accomplishments ahead of their own. And if the Dodgers were going to win that game, Clayton would say that was the most important thing.
Very nice. Okay, Lindsay's won me over here with that high level view. I like it. My understanding in Japan, I read a book called "You Got to Have Wa." WA. It was written a long time ago. It was a fantastic book. But apparently, they have that that workmanlike philosophy with the training in general, and so the baseball players are working out and training hard and running sprints for hours every day, and the pitchers are throwing at high volume many days per week. It's just total flip-flop, and it's to get the arm stronger and more resilient to throw more pitches. So a few pitchers have come over here and made it and done pretty well, Ohtani and the rest, but it's just kind of an interesting compare and contrast. Yeah, and
I would be curious to see what they're doing on the flip side too, because as you know, as a triathlete, what you take out, you have to put back in somehow. Hmm. Right. So I would be curious to see what the recovery side of that looks like.
So back to the interviews and the wonderful body of content at Food of the Gods, where you're getting into the dietary patterns and picking up tips and tricks from the disparate athletes in so many sports. You mentioned that you didn't have a lot of examples of people involved in these extreme dietary restriction strategies that are so popular in the progressive health movement. That's extremely interesting to me because I'm trying to pass myself off as an athlete in the older age groups here. So I'm training for high jumping, sprinting, speed golf, and it's pretty stressful to do anything of that nature in the 55 plus division. And then here I am on the other end, deeply involved in the progressive health scene and experimenting with what might be considered extreme and restrictive dietary strategies. So wonder what that's like with your group of athletes.
So you're right. Not a lot of them are into the whole extreme eating. Like I don't think I've interviewed anybody who came back and said they were keto or paleo. There were some folks who had like experimented with things like that, but they always end up coming back to just the balanced diet. We did have one hockey player, Michael Delzato, who was a pretty strict intermittent faster.
And is that during the season? Was he doing that in the off season?
He did it all the time, but I think he's an exception to the rule. There were a bunch of athletes who were gluten-free, a bunch of athletes who were dairy-free, but even the gluten-free folks were finding other sources of complex carbohydrate. Like I said, the brown rice, the quinoa, the sweet potatoes, that kind of thing. It seems to all just sort of come back to people making balanced, colorful plates with lots of lean protein, fruit and veggies, the complex carb, and that healthy fats being a really, really big deal. I think that's another thing that, I mean, the keto and paleo world has certainly embraced that a lot of normal folks are, I have to eat fat free. Like, no, you don't. Eat more fat. More fat is good for you. The good kind, obviously, not Doritos. But I do think that the vast majority of the athletes that we've had on Food of the Gods do lean more towards balance than towards any of the ultra restrictive diets.
And I've all, you know, as a former athlete, especially in the endurance scene and doing the triathlon stuff, this scientific research would come out about this, that, or the other thing, where shorter workouts at higher intensity will boost your fitness more than going around and pedaling all day at a slow pace. And then I'm looking around at the greatest athletes in every endurance sport throughout the last 60 years, training in a certain way and highly validating that in comparison to what everyone thinks is the ultimate or the pinnacle is show me the science. You hear that quote all the time, or research reveals that free weights are better than machines. And then the other research reveals that machines are better than free weights. So I look strongly to who's out there at the front of the pack, setting records to what might be the optimal human way of training, eating, and living.
I mean, I think you really have to look at what the person is doing, right? Like if you want to be a marathoner, right, you have to train to run marathons, which means you're going to be out there doing long distance stuff. But if you want to be the fastest 100 meter sprinter in the world, running 26 miles isn't going to do squat for you. You need to train the explosive fast twitch power to be able to sustain a top speed for only 10 seconds. Right. So I think, and also like this crap about, I'm the fittest, I'm the best athlete, I'm the this, but like you're the best at what you do. Right. But if you put a marathoner and tell them to go into a powerlifting competition, they're not going to do very well. But at the same time, the powerlifter is going to do terrible at the marathon. So I think you really just have to look at what you want to do and what adaptations are necessary to accomplish that particular goal, right? It was interesting. I did a story for Men's Health very recently about this fitness challenge that was going around on the internet where guys were trying to deadlift 500 pounds mm-hmm. and run a sub 5 minute mile. Mm-hmm. And that is that is something that like the CrossFit world would point to as something that is, would require a very high level of fitness and adaptation in two different, very different modalities, right? So Ryan Hall from your world, he's still an American record holder in the half marathon. He was 135 pounds soaking wet with rocks in his pockets when he was running marathons. He's now 195 pounds.
Jacked as heck.
Crazy. He was doing, he tried to do this deadlift thing and admits that he didn't do it properly. First of all, he put the barbell, perpendicular to the track. So he did the deadlift and then had to jump over the barbell he tripped over it. Right. So everybody, if you're going to try this, turn the barbell sideways. Right. Anyway, but he didn't do it. He ran a 5:28 or something. And for some perspective, after pulling that 500-pound deadlift, he ran a 5:28 mile. His American record in the half marathon was way below that, 4:40s or something. Right. So he did 13 of them without the 500-pound deadlift, but with the 500-pound deadlift, couldn't do one of them. So it's so interesting when you think about endurance versus power and how you train specifically for all of those things. And I think when you're eating or training to accomplish any goal, you really have to look at what that goal is and what type of eating and training is going to get you to it.
Good point. And in some sports, let's face it, it doesn't matter that much. John Daly, one of the great golfers, mm-hmm. and he has two major titles, which is two more than many of the superstars that we revere today. And he had zero attention to any of those things.
Oh, and he would smoke on the course, for God's sake. I know.
Smoking and Oreo cookies. And
I also think about, you remember John Kruk from the Phillies?
Yeah.
All-star baseball player. And he's got a famous quote, "I'm not an athlete, I'm a ball player."
Speaking of that, do you have some favorite quotes of your grandfather, who's maybe the most quotable athlete of all time, people, Yogi Berra?
Well, yeah. So people ask me this all the time, and my favorites are the most existential ones. Like, people like the funny ones, but I like "the future ain't what it used to be. If the world were perfect, it wouldn't be." You know, they're true, but they're a little
bit. What was the second one you said? Sorry.
If the world were perfect, it wouldn't be. You know, because we're always complaining about something, but if it was like that, you'd find something else to complain about. Let's be honest, right?
That is brilliant. That's absolutely brilliant.
There is one really funny one that I like that I tell people a lot that most people have not heard because it was kind of more of an in the family thing. In 1958, when Grandpa and Mickey Mantle became pitchmen for Yoo-hoo, the chocolate milk drink. Milk. I use air quotes around milk because I don't think it's a dairy product. In 1958, they had a press conference and there was a female reporter in the front row. And Grandpa always remembered this because female reporters in 1958 were very rare. Mm. And she raised her hand and she said, "Excuse me, is that hyphenated?" She was asking about the word Yoo-hoo. Is it hyphenated? And Grandpa said, "Lady, it ain't even carbonated." And that is one of my favorite silly yogisms.
Oh my gosh. I knew we'd get the inside scoop from you. Yeah. That is beautiful. Back to that, the deadlifting and the 5 minute mile, which is super cool challenge. I'm sure Ryan Hall will do it when he goes down to sea level and gets ready. Yeah, I think one guy has done it already. The San Diego, legendary, CrossFit guy. I forget his name. But people have done it.
And, the first guy to do it was a guy named Adam Klink.
Okay.
CrossFitter named Adam Klink. And then some other folks have done it too. And what Adam did actually, he, kind of extrapolated the challenge and took it from it originally was put forth by the CrossFit Games programmer, Dave Castro, in his book. And it was deadlift 500 pounds, back squat 500 pounds, which is considerably more difficult than deadlifting 500 pounds, and then run the 5 minute mile, and all in the same day. And Adam Klink was the first person to do all three of those. And he, some other folks, I'm forgetting their names. You can actually, if anyone wants to Google my story, Google five and 500 challenge men's health, and all the history of it is in that story. Ryan Hall tried it, at 8,000 feet, I believe. Mm-hmm. So he would have to do that down to at sea level. That right after I spoke with him about, him missing on that challenge, he was doing a thing where he was running to the bottom of the Grand Canyon with two of those 50-gallon water jugs things, filling them at the bottom, and then farmers carrying them out. And I'm like, this is what you think is fun on a Sunday? Oh, but he did that. He did it.
Yeah, very impressive. I wonder what you think. The CrossFit community likes to tout that they're the fittest all-around athletes. My friend sent me a text after one of the games, and he said, Matthew Frazier is the fittest human who's ever lived on Earth. Care to argue that? And I'm like, you know, that's a pretty good take right there, man. Because in terms of the term fittest, I'd say I'm going to ask you two ending questions. So what do you think about what represents the fittest athlete? And then I want your list of like the greatest athletes in terms of, you know.
Different ways to look at this. Like, I wouldn't argue with saying Matthew Frazier is way the hell up there, because if Matthew Frazier had to run a marathon, he could. And if Matthew Frazier had a back squat 500 pounds, he could. Matthew Frazier is probably not trained in the skill of a particular sport. So when you look at someone like a Roger Federer or a Serena Williams, those folks, they're tremendous athletes, but they have an incredibly specific skill set that works to their sport. So the greatest tennis players of all time, yes. Matthew Frazier might be one of the greatest or fittest athletes, just about what the potential of the human body is, but he's not, he couldn't beat Serena Williams at tennis. But then again, Serena Williams, while she probably has a really good power clean, probably couldn't compete with the CrossFitters in the power clean, you know? So it just depends. I almost think it's like a dumb argument, like, cause you're just going to go in circles. And I don't understand why we can't say Serena Williams is the greatest tennis player of all time and Matthew Frazier is the fittest human on earth at the moment. Like, why can't they both be true? You know?
Yeah. And also it kind of bugs me to go and compare eras and will Tiger Woods break Jack Nicklaus's record? Guess what? He's already destroyed that in so many ways because the level of competition is so much higher. And I'm going to argue that, you know, dominating in the modern era when the 100th place guy is making $1 million a year is different than when Jack Nicklaus, the 100th place guy on tour, was selling shoes in the winter in Florida. And I don't want to denigrate the athletes of the past, but you know, the records are made to be broken, of course. And also the sophistication of sports is so much higher that there's no sense comparing eras.
I totally agree with you. And like, for the record, my grandfather worked in a hardware store. He sold Christmas trees on the hill in St. Louis and then got sick of working odd jobs. And he and Phil Rizzuto opened a bowling alley to have something to provide income in the off season. So grandpa's best year in the big leagues, he made $60,000, which is the equivalent of $550,000 in today's money, which is $200,000 below the league minimum. And people say if grandpa were playing today, he'd be unpayable given his winning percentage, right? But grandpa, you know, people ask me this about a lot too, about grandpa, about comparing him to catchers in the modern era. But like, my grandfather still has World Series hit record for catchers. He still has more RBIs than any catcher in history. I don't think, like, Yadier Molina might catch him, but he would have to hit 400 more RBIs before he retires. So I think that you know, those, there are some records that stand the test of time. And some of those athletes from way back, like Jack Nicklaus, were so good that there will be records that won't be broken, but they were like genetic freaks and once in a generation type athletes, right? I think, and not everyone in the league at that time or on the PGA Tour at the time could hold a candle to those folks. Whereas nowadays, the base level of athlete in the pro sport is much higher. And yes, you still have those standout people, but I think across the board, the level of athlete has improved.
Very nice. Lindsay Barra, the sports machine, just cranking. I love catching up with you. And maybe we'll have to have another fireside chat about all manner of sports opinions, like all the great sports talk shows. It was a pleasure. I'm amazed at all the depth of your knowledge and your experience in so many different sports too, which is quite unique. Give us a little plug for Food of the Gods. How do we check in with that and what can we expect?
So Food of the Gods podcast is about how elite athletes eat and train to fuel performance. We've had some great episodes. Some of my favorites, Justin Sua, the mental performance coach for the Tampa Bay Rays. That was one of my favorites. The Gary Player episode was right up there. I loved the recent one with Emma Coburn, the steeplechaser. Michael Lorenzen, MLB pitcher, was pretty interesting. Jimmy Johnson, the NASCAR driver turned IndyCar driver who will be racing in his first Indy 500 next week, was on the podcast. Alex Pello, last year's IndyCar champ, was on the podcast. The CrossFitters out there can listen to Jason Kalipa's episode. We've really had a very wide variety of athletes, and it's super fun. And you can find it on any podcast platform or at our website, foodofthegodspodcast.com.
We can follow you on social media, follow the show.
I'm very easy to find, at Lindsay Berra. It's horrifyingly easy to Google. You can find me anywhere.
Get involved, people. She's highly carbonated. Thank you, Lindsay Berra. Thanks for listening, everybody.
I am not highly carbonated. No carbonated beverages for me. They hurt my belly. Da, 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 da,
da. Thank you for listening to the show. I love sharing the experience with you and greatly appreciate your support. Please email podcast@bradventures.com with feedback, suggestions, and questions for the Q&A shows. Subscribe to our email list at bradkearns.com for a weekly blast about the published episodes and a wonderful bi-monthly newsletter edition with informative articles and practical tips for all aspects of healthy living. You can also download several awesome free ebooks when you subscribe to the email list. And if you could go to the trouble to leave a 5 or 5-star review with Apple Podcasts or wherever else you listen to the shows, that would be super incredibly awesome. It helps raise the profile of the BRAD podcast and attract new listeners. And did you know that you can share a show with a friend or loved one by just hitting a few buttons in your player and firing off a text message? My awesome podcast player called Overcast allows you to actually record a soundbite excerpt from the episode you're listening to and fire it off with a quick text message. Thank you so much for spreading the word. And remember, be rad.